Hello and welcome to the podcast. The Radar figures are out this week. They measure how many people are listening to which radio station and what is up and what is down. I'll be discussing the latest figures with Matt Deegan, co-founder of Folder Media and co-founder of the British Podcast Awards. He's one of the most respected commentators on all things audio, and is also the co-founder of the award-winning Fun Kids digital radio station for families and children, which has just won the Bronze Award in the Radio Academy's UK Station of the Year category. Given that the Gold Award went to the BBC Asian Network and the Silver to Talk Sport, that's a considerable achievement for a small independent station. I want to talk to Matt about audio for children, about the BBC's proposals to put ads on some of its podcasts, a disastrous decision according to the independent sector, and about those radio listening figures. Well, welcome to the podcast, Matt, and congratulations on the Radio Academy Award. Were you surprised, as well as, of course, us delighted to get it?
Always pleased. It's always nice to be nominated. It's good to get a podium finish. We've been really fortunate, actually. This is the third year in a row we've been nominated for UK Station of the Year. And why is that? Hopefully we do good entries. Hopefully the radio station is quite good. Also, I think we do something that's quite different to a lot of other radio stations, in that in some ways we're quite old-fashioned. We're sort of a full-service radio station, a bit like you'd get on local radio in the 80s. You know, we do a little bit of everything. There's pop music, there's science, there's books, there's stories. And so actually, when we put together an entry, and often we listen back to it and go, oh, we did quite a bit this year, didn't we? Which I think if you're a more niche service, and a lot of radio has gone a bit more niche, that's perhaps harder to do.
And you're doing it, you're broadcasting obviously on radio, but also digitally. So if people want to access it, what do they do? Where do they access it? What do they do?
So Fun Kids is a children's radio station for children under 10 and their families. It's on DAB in lots of cities across the country. It's not truly national, but it's in lots of cities, including London and the southeast. But a lot of our material, of our speech material, is available as a podcast as well. So we have lots of different podcast channels. We're the biggest creator of kids content in the UK and probably Europe as well. And so you can get us in Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and that way listen to the linear stream on DAB, the Fun Kids app, or on smart speakers and TuneIn and other places too.
And you haven't any idea what your overall reach is?
So we measure our reach in Radar in London, which is kind of a core place for us. And we've just had our highest ever Radar. We have 129,000 10 pluses listening to Fun Kids. So that doesn't even include our target audience, and that's because Radar doesn't measure under 10s. And across the UK, we do some research, and it puts us at about 500,000 listeners across the whole country.
Now, this is quite extraordinary. I'm not saying this because when I was presenting feedback for the BBC, I go back as all the way to when Radio 4 was still trying to experiment with children's radio. And it strikes me the BBC basically gave up in radio. Well, not strikes me. It did give up on radio. It thought there is not an audience there. So why are you succeeding and why they didn't?
So I think what is difficult, so I'll speak positively at the BBC and negatively about the BBC. So on the positive side, you know, in a modern world, it's very hard to have some different kinds of programming on a radio station and assume that listeners will find that. So the couple of different goes that the BBC had at doing kids radio more recently, a show on Radio 4 that basically the Radar show that didn't really have any children listening to it. You know, that's difficult to find. It's not a station that families think of to listen to the radio with their kids. And then they had segments on BBC 7, later 4 Extra as well. And again, larger part of the schedule, and it was more regular. But again, you know, BBC 7 4 Extra is not a children's radio service. You know, it's basically a, you know, archive comedy and drama station. So it wasn't really the right place for it. I mean, what is interesting is they do have a children's channel, and then they have CBeebies Radio, which you can get on BBC Sounds. It's not particularly well supported or marketed by the BBC. It's a lot of very good content that's sort of looped a bit like a sort of kids jukebox of mainly speech content. And what we know from that audience is, while speech is very valuable, it's difficult to build a service around that, particularly one that doesn't have a lot of presentation or a lot of kind of traditional scheduling. So they've never quite I don't think, done the sort of the right thing on the right platform for the audience. And also, I don't think it's ever been particularly well supported internally as a kind of interesting thing to do. Kids' audio is hard. It's different to adult material. It requires a focus. And also, because it's not really measured, as I mentioned, with Radar doesn't measure under 10s. It is hard to look at it and go, hey, this is making an impact for us from a public service perspective. And even for us as a commercial radio station, you know, it's difficult to kind of turn those numbers into cash in the way that a normal radio station would.
And of course, if you look at broadcast television, again, that's in deep trouble, isn't it? Channel 5 does Milkshake. ITV does not a lot, as far as I can see. And then you look at the BBC and say something like Blue Peter, and the figures for people, kids who actually watch when it's broadcast are hardly measurable, are they? I mean, I was astounded the other day to find out how much they dropped.
It's pretty small, but what you've got from the television side is, you know, CBeebies as the TV channel, hugely well regarded by parents, you know, the ad-free environment, high quality, you know, UK originated material, well thought out, makes that a very successful channel. CBBC channel, not as popular as it used to be, but still not bad, still pretty good. The problem is just the evolution is that children don't think about linear kind of at all, but in the television world. And why should they? You know, linear is mad. The idea that someone has chosen some programs for you and they've put them on at a certain time and you have to tune in to get them. I mean, it is crazy. We all grew up with it, so it just seems very normal.
Now, hold on. There is a sense, though, in which, and maybe the big question but nobody knows the answer to is, will listening viewing habits change as kids get older? Will they want to be part of a shared experience that we all watch something together at the same time and can react? For example, I've you know, just been watching Blue Lights, you know, which I just love on BBC One, although of course you can watch all episodes anyway, but I want to talk to people about that.
But I think it's a good point, and I think kids are so used to having access to the remote control or the tablet or mum and dad's phone to get kind of what they want when they want it. And, you know, there's a bit of, you know, is it all sugar and not having their greens? And the good thing about linear television is it did mean you could encourage them to watch things that maybe they wouldn't choose to watch, which I think is a challenge. And that's partly a parental challenge as well as one for children. But children accessing iPlayer or kids' content on Netflix or Amazon or YouTube, more likely YouTube, they are very comfortable doing that. And so trying to insert linear, that's quite difficult. That's not to say that things like Doctor Who or Strictly or Gladiators are definitely programs which kind of bring the family together and are potentially a linear experience and a shared moment, though kind of, as you just said there, like some of that is, yes, we're watching it, but we're watching it.
So if the BBC is doing really well, or pretty well with CBeebies and so on, what was the gap in the market that you spotted that you felt that you could meet that the BBC perhaps is not meeting? Or was it just that it needs competition?
So Fun Kids start in quite a strange way. So one of our other businesses is we run some digital radio multiplexes. So we're like a kind of platform operator and we broadcast BBC and commercial radio to kind of counties, really, across the country. And when we were starting that up, this idea of having a sort of shop window radio station seemed quite a good idea that we could point to and go, hey, you could launch a country station or you could launch a heavy metal station. Look, we've launched a kids one and this is how it works. And so it was sort of there as a demonstrator, and it had a bit of a history before at a company where we'd worked at GWR and GCAP, and Susan Stranks, who'd been a children's campaigner, had been involved in the early days of what became Fun Radio, which we then acquired and turned into Fun Kids in 2009, so a long time ago. So it started off as a shop window, and in the conversation I had with my partner, it was, as long as it kind of washes its face, that'll be fine. You know, it doesn't cause us too much trouble. And then a strange thing happened in that it was really interesting to do, and then listeners started listening to it, and then there was some interest from advertisers, and over that time it's grown to be quite a large part of our business from a staffing perspective. It's maybe not the thing that generates as much cash as other things that we do, but it generally has a lot of effort goes into it, and it still washes its face, which is important. And I think we do it because it's a good thing to do. We do it because it's an interesting part of our business. We do it because actually a lot of what we do in all of our things is about relationships with listeners and the technology radio and media companies use to reach listeners in a modern world. And kids are a great way to experiment. They are at the cutting edge of stuff. And so all of the things that we actually learn doing Fun Kids is useful for some of the other work that we do. But we mainly do it because we think it's a good thing, and we know that there are audiences there, both in linear and in on demand, and the response we get from children is significant, and they really value it, and it's fun.
Does it mean that we shouldn't worry about BBC? We shouldn't lobby the BBC and say, hey, keep up, what are you doing for children, whatever? Should we just say, well, that's all right, the market's going to deliver that. You concentrate on things that the market isn't delivering.
I mean, the bit that I find slightly disappointing when I talk about Fun Kids is everyone's very excited about Fun Kids. They love that it's there, and, you know, we're award-winning, so the content must be half-decent, and we've got all these listeners. And it's like there's only a couple of us doing this as a small business, and, you know, colleagues at Global and Bauer, who I have a huge amount of respect with, I think, you know, we are growing your new listeners. Maybe you'd like to help support some of the stuff we do. And I sort of feel the same way about the BBC, is actually Fun Kids is quite public service. And would it be perhaps a good idea if there was a bit more industry support, purely by being, a motivated self-interest? You know, surely growing the listeners of tomorrow.
Are you saying, let me be specific, is that a coded way of saying that if the BBC offered a partnership agreement with you, you would have a serious conversation with them?
Absolutely. And we've had a few discussions over the years about things. And, you know, BBC Sounds has third-party content. Maybe Fun Kids should exist in there. I don't think they're particularly for it or against it, and we have a good relationship with sort of everybody. But I think there's an opportunity to support it. The other one that I've talked about publicly is, you know, we cover 6 to 10 year olds. Actually, I think there's also a real opportunity for sort of teenagers, and what's the UK radio industry and what's the public broadcasters doing to support interesting and media and audio consumption for teenagers. And I've said, you know, we would happily help being part of that as well, but perhaps commercial radio and the BBC should work together on younger children and older children.
Well, it's interesting because that would require you to be on really good terms with each other, and there's a recent development which suggests that relationships sort of cooled a little. The BBC in March announced plans to sell adverts on some of its podcasts for UK listeners on sites such as Apple and so on, and Spotify. And how should I best describe the reaction of your side of the industry? Well, you called it disastrous, didn't you? Why was it disastrous? Because, you know, from the Beeb's point of view, income's down, you know, over 30%, they keep saying. They're encouraged by government. They've got to go and find more revenue. There's a big view in broadcasting house advertising. The Beeb's isn't, you know, getting enough return in the States. It's investing heavily. It's advertising there. Why are you so opposed to it advertising on podcasts?
So, as we all know, and as your very bright listeners know, if they're listening to this, they have a certain expertise in media. There is not one BBC. There are 5 or 6 BBCs, and there's different groups of people who have different views and they have different objectives. At the very obvious level, there's sort of the BBC public service end, and then there's the BBC studios end, and they are not aligned entirely with their visions.
No, because studios essentially have to raise revenue. Their job, and the reason programmes and dares are put into studios, is because they think they can make money, particularly abroad and elsewhere. So it's a very much more commercial part of the BBC than, if you like, the in-house public service element.
And they've been tasked to do it. Yeah, they've been tasked to get on with it and make some money, because at some point the licence fee may be disappear completely or be cut. And you know, I think there's a bit of a view, how high can we get up to maintain the existing funding? And to do that, it's going to take a number of years and a bit of everything. Now, what the BBC is saying, so with this, what they're saying is BBC, so a lot of BBC public service audio, the people that make that, which used to be kind of BBC production, has moved to BBC Sounds. So the same way that a lot of television production has sort of gone in-house to BBC Sounds, a lot of audio has now done that as well. So the teams have shifted and changed, and the people who are sort of the brand owner of something like Desert Island Discs is sort of no longer the public service end, it's the BBC Studios end. And they're going, okay, well, if that's the case, we might have some t-shirts, we might do some tours, and hey, what should we do with the on-demand audio? Now, what they point to is UK TV. So this is things like, you know, UK Gold and Dave and things like that. And they go, well, you know, that's BBC content on a commercial social platform and that has advertising in. We're just suggesting the same with podcasts. So any podcast that you listen to in a commercial environment, a bit like you listen to, you watch Dave on Freeview or Freesat, we're going to put ads in it.
Well, that's their argument, and it's a perfectly coherent argument.
Well, I don't think it is.
Well, it's a coherent in the sense that if its job is to increase revenue outside the license fee, on the other hand, the net result will be, what would happen to the podcast market if there was widespread use of advertising on BBC podcasts?
Well, before we get there, I think that the difference is putting ads on old episodes of QI is different to putting ads on first run podcast content on certain platforms. And even like having show BBC shows on Netflix, they're not first run. Like, so if you want to listen to Desert Island Discs on demand and you... it was on last week, and so you want to listen straight away on demand. At the moment, you do that, and you get a BBC public service environment, which is ad-free. In the UK, we have first-run content is ad-free for the BBC. Whereas what they're saying with this is there will be ads on, not on BBC Sounds, which will stay ad-free. Instead, on Apple and Spotify, they will put adverts on there. And that is a change. That's basically introducing ads into BBC content. Now, that might be one of the future ways the BBC is funded, but like, let's have that discussion as we lead up to 2027, and let's talk about it in the round of all of the ways to fund the BBC. Don't sort of get it in slightly by the back door. Now, the crazy thing with this is, the absolutely mad thing with this is the way they're going about it. One is just sort of dropping it in, no real discussion, and I think it's a little bit confused, and it has annoyed everybody in the commercial space. So if I'm a commercial podcast company, I make money generally from advertising in two ways. I get it from dynamically inserted adverts, which are generally sold in bulk as by networks. So, you know, for my podcast, I do a podcast called The Media Podcast, Acast seller adverts, and they insert the ads and we don't really have anything to do with it. And they just look at our numbers and they pop the ads in there. And what they do is look at all of their podcasters and all of the impacts that those podcasts provide. And they look at all their advertising and they divide one by the other. And I get a very small amount of that. And that works the same if you go a step up of like the whole advertising sector. So all the advertisers in the UK are advertising on podcasts. They have a certain amount of money and that gets split a number of ways, partly how they want them split and how much there is in the market. So if suddenly you add in a load more BBC inventory into that pot, I might have been getting 50% of my ad spots filled, but now I might be getting 30% because now we've got to share that money with the BBC as well. So like, net result number one, available ad pool increases or impacts increase, the ad pool doesn't increase, so my money decreases. And that's the core problem. The BBC say, well, actually, we might help grow the market by bringing big, you know, great podcast content to the advertising market. Perhaps 10 years ago, but not anymore. The BBC is still, they produce quite a lot of podcasts that generate quite a lot of listening, but they're not the biggest player. They're not driving the market. People aren't going, oh, amazing, the BBC has joined the podcast market. How amazing for us. They are just diluting the pool. So that's number one. Number two, they have already implemented a load of random BBC type rules into how the advertising will work. So they said, oh, it's not going to be on news programs because that would be wrong. Well, let's ignore the fact that in the US, where there's news podcasts, they have adverts. BBC News Channel overseas, that has adverts. So I can see why they're doing it, because they're scared here in the UK. So there is a concern. There is a difference. It isn't the same as what they're doing elsewhere. Okay, so you've got that. They've also said they're not going to do live reads. This is where you have someone endorsing the benefits of a mattress or HelloFresh or something like that.
Just pause a moment while we discuss this, but just for a quick word for adverts, and or sometime the presenter will say, if you want to sleep tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure how well that would go down, but yes, yes.
And Melvin Bragg is not going to be doing live reads for shaving products on In Our Time. But so you take out the news, you take out the live reads, and whilst it's still a significant amount of money they'll make, it's not actually that much. I think it will be a push just under £1 million a year.
And the result of that may well be to put people, I don't say like you, but some podcasters out of business, because this is a very early stages and relatively fragile revenue stream. So you're really worried that if they do this, some people will go out of business.
Well, I think that that is true. And Ollie Mann, who's been a podcaster for quite a long time, he did some tweets this week and he was saying, you know, his history podcast, which he regards as a public service podcast, is a fun history show, is about break even. And you take 20% of the income out of that, that makes it something which is harder to make exist. The BBC already gets £5.7 billion of income from a variety of sources. It does not need £1 million a year out of the podcast business that, you know, I could go in and find seven managers to fire and I could save £1 million.
Yes, I think I could double that. But don't you think that this may not come to pass? Surely, because one of the jobs of the regulator, I mean, the BBC, they do a market impact test, don't they? And they say if the BBC is, it's usually new services, but some new development like this, they have to take into account the consequences on the market. Now, you presumably are all going to Ofcom and saying precisely that. Do you think there's a good chance that Ofcom will say to the BBC, no, you can't do it?
5 years ago, but as you've discussed on the show, Ofcom's decisions now are weird, are just strange, and they are unpredictable. They used to be an incredibly predictable regulator. They are no longer a predictable regulator. So BBC things that with Ofcom at the moment will be this. Also, the launch of BBC's new radio services. That's with them as well. So it's difficult to tell.
Sorry, this is a new service. It was sort of an extension of Radio 2 and goes into territory where Greatest Hits Radio has established that there is a market, and Boom Radio in particularly recently has established that there is a small but important market there.
And Greatest Hits Radio has just had its best ever radio. So, you know, they're building a market. So I've had some discussions with friends and colleagues at the BBC. On the podcasting side, pretty much no one I've spoke to at the BBC, kind of public service end of things, wants it to happen, and they all think it's a mess, and they all think it's confused everybody, and they're not sure what the value is. Pretty much without exception, that's the view. And I don't think it's actually going to happen, because I think they've been surprised by the response. I think it's opened up a lot of questions internally, and I think it may go by the wayside. But what it's a great example of, and these launch of these radio stations, the same. Some of this is professional jealousy. Now, some of it is reaching license fee payers and doing a good job for them. Sometimes it is about making more money for the corporation. But also sometimes it's they see what happens in the commercial market and they go, that makes sense. And I really wish we'd done that previously, or we weren't able to, and that we should get on with it. And by the time they've had the discussions and got it approved, it's a few more years in, and then it seems like it's a copycat thing. And there is an element of that in a lot of these places. So in the commercial audio world, you also have to remember the BBC have been so dominant for so long. Commercial radio only started in the early 70s. And we've just got to a point where commercial radio's total hours is bigger than the BBC. The podcasting sector, again, BBC were very in it early, helped define it in the UK, absolutely, because it had loads of speech content. But now you've got a really interesting commercial audio market making good quality speech programming. And I'm sorry, but it's not the job of the BBC to wade into that market anymore, or to really, really push it, or to try and regain its dominance. It is a large part of those markets. It will remain a large part. It doesn't need to keep pushing it. The commercial sector is adequately fulfilling that need.
Well, I do recognise his imperial tendencies. The BBC go a long way back. I remember the launch of Breakfast Television being another example of, well, we really want to do it, but we can't have ITV getting ahead. Anyway, there we are. That's another matter. Just look, we just had the latest Rajars, and I just wonder, is there anything that really stands out to you?
So it's been quite a good book for a lot of radio stations, and that's partly because all radio listening is up. So 89% of the UK listen to some form of radio every week, which we should all be incredibly proud of, both BBC and commercial radio.
Yeah, and shocked, because less than 30 years ago, people in the BBC were convinced that radio was coming to an end as a dominant force. Now it's been one of the great revelations. Sorry, I interrupted you. Carry on, yeah.
So all radio listening is up, which means that a lot of stations have done quite well, particularly on the commercial side. Radio 3 has had a good book. They're up to just under 2 million listeners. They've been a little bit soft recently, so they'll be pleased. And this is before their slightly altered schedule, Sam Jackson's slightly altered schedule, so it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next few quarters. Radio 4 is pretty static. 5 Live doesn't get a lot of chat about Five Live. You know, it's under 5 million. You know, the AM network is probably going to be switched off in the next 18 months. You know, digital only brand. It being a news and sport network, as we move on, makes it harder and harder for that to exist. When I talked about that, you know, kids' content.
Why? Because you think the rights, whereas they did, there used to be a situation where there was a battle for television rights, and actually you could pick up the radio rights for very little. Now there's competition there, and inevitably, presumably, a DG sitting down, how much do I allocate to sport to buy things? It's going to be very difficult to ask. So you think that's a real existential threat to Five Live as a news and sport network?
I think that's a question, but bigger than that, I think it is confusing combining news and sport together in a modern world. There's a group of people that would quite like the news bit of Five Live and a group of listeners that would quite like the sport bit of Five Live. And, you know, should Sports Extra, in a, you know, we're predominantly digital radio listening environment now, should that be Five Live Sport and regular Five Live becomes Five Live News? I think there are some issues from the commercial sector, particularly from Talk Sport, about whether that should be allowed to happen. But clearly, I think there's a challenge for Five Live. Greatest Hits had some great figures, up nearly a million. That's partly driven by their sort of acquisition of smaller radio licenses that Bauer, the owner, has bought over the years. But its weekly reach of 7.6 million is incredibly strong, really, really strong, bigger than the Capital Network, which is important kind of commercially for them too. And then you've got stations which kind of always should do better than they seem to do. Times Radio, which I think is a great listen, keeps kind of bumbling about 500,000 listeners. And it probably deserves and probably needs to have a million listeners. So it'd be interesting to see where they go. I saw Tim Lavelle, the boss there, speak this week. And on air, they're very focusing on being the election station and covering the UK and the US elections, as well as some of the elections around the world. And he talked a lot about having a, you know, a clear marketing position for that station. But I think one of their challenges is their name. You know, Times Radio, for lots of people who, if you don't get that newspaper, or you have a view about that newspaper, does that stop you listening? And the broadcast radio product is probably a bit broader politically and a bit broader than the newspaper is. So again, that's a kind of interesting challenge for them. Talk Radio has done quite well, which is in the News UK stable. A lot of issues with Talk Radio and Talk TV and the rebrands and the people changing.
And shock jocks. They've got quite a few shock jocks on there now, as I know to my cost. I may be trying to be interviewed by one. But finally, because I'm running out of time, thank you for that analysis. And let me ask you the ridiculous question, which is in 5 years' time, and because we mainly look at the Beeb and whatever. Do you think that the BBC doesn't now have a majority of radio listening? But if you were to pitch it, I mean, at the present moment, you think that, you know, in 5 years' time, it'll still have, a third, something like that? There's no reason to, if it keeps delivering, it shouldn't have that sort of substantial part of the market.
I think it's still going to be around the same level it is now. It may seem a little bit of softening, but I don't think hugely. What they do with Radio 3, Radio 4 and Radio 2 is wide-ranging, reaches large audiences, and I can't see that instantly changing overnight. The challenge for them, like is for lots of broadcasters, is younger audiences. Do they get a habit of listening to BBC channels? Radio 1's figures have sort of stabilised, but they're at a much lower level than they were a few years ago, and I think that's going to be more difficult. Also seeing that for Kiss and Capital, the commercial competitors. And in the podcast space, I think they will push more into on-demand audio. BBC Studios will be focused on international audio, shows which work in the UK and the US. That will end up having a bit of a knock-on on what is broadcast as well in the UK. But I think their audio focus will be overseas, and it will still do quite well here. But the commercial audio market and the podcast market, particularly if these ads rules are rejected, will continue to grow, and it will be harder for them to maintain their dominance because it's such a more competitive space. But I think radio, probably not that dissimilar to what we see today.
And overall, when you stand back, the fact is the listener is so much better served now than they have ever been, haven't they?
We're in a golden age of audio. Not only can they listen to this podcast or my media podcast, they can listen to a huge amount of material. It's never been so good for listeners. And isn't it brilliant that in this digital screen-led world, that audio has got this renaissance? And this idea of a thing you can have on in the background, or as you go for a walk, or you take the dog out, or whatever, has great moments that really support people's lives. And that's seemingly hasn't been changing, and I don't think will be in the near future.
Well, thank you very much, Thomas, Matt, Stegan, and I hope that Fun Kids is there in 5 years' time and greatly expanded. Thank you for talking to us.
No worries.
Our thanks to Matt Deegan, co-founder of Fun Kids and founder of the new media and radio consultancy firm Folder Media. As Matt pointed out, podcasts rely on advertising, which we've chosen not to have. So if you appreciate our journalism, please consider funding our endeavours either with a one-off payment on our crowdfunding page or regularly by signing up to patreon.com/bewatch for £1.99 per month, where you'll also receive a weekly blog which gives my take on the week's interview. The link to this and our crowdfunding page can be found in the description of this programme. And that's it for this week. As you know, this podcast is presented by me, Roger Bolton, and it's produced by Kate Dixon. The sound is by Dave Kitto, and special thanks to Quinn Genty. It's a good egg production. Until next time, goodbye.